You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is A Mindful Life with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the program. I do hope you enjoy it.
I'm Richard Horton, a recently retired police sergeant, currently part-time shelf stacker at Sainsbury's and a library assistant, and in years long gone by, the author of the Orwell Prize-winning Nightjar blog.
Thanks very much for coming on, Richard. I do appreciate it, especially on a Sunday morning. Perhaps just tell us a little bit about your upbringing, really.
Okay, I'm the oldest of four boys. Hence, when I tweet at I of IV, sort of Roman one of four. So I'm 58. Grew up around Ramsbottom in Lancashire and latterly for my A-levels in Keswick in Cumbria. Joined the police 30 years ago after a short career in accountancy because I really wanted to join the police in the end. I guess being the oldest of four, I was brought up that fairness was very important. My mum and my dad drove into me this idea of fairness, that you treat your brothers fairly, you treat other people fairly. Mum and dad always treat us fairly. My dad had this saying, a penny bun cost fourpence, because he'd never do for one what they couldn't do for the others. And that was decent. So some people come into policing because they want to help the community or they want to do service and that kind of thing. I think looking back, what put me into policing was the idea that I could bring fairness into more people's lives, that I could get fairness or justice for victims of crime. And that's been a driver for me, I think, through my police career, both in terms of dealing with public, with dealing with victims, suspects, with colleagues. Fairness has always been a really important thing for me. Here I am now, 30 years at the end of the career and spreading out into doing other things. I've sought some voluntary work in the local library, doing some IT work with them. About 7 or 8 years ago, I was made a fellow of the Orwell Society, which I was really pleased about. Yeah. But part of that is you're meant to try and put some things back into society in terms of literature, in terms of literacy. And I saw going into the library service as a volunteer as a way that I could make that contribution back and do something to promote some of those values. That's me, really.
Well, just before we go on to your policing career, just something that you said about four penny buns.
Yes.
I mean, you yourself have a good, what I would say is a good turn of phrase, which you've brought into your writing, and we'll talk about that more later. But do you think you got your love of words from your father, or where do you think that came from?
I have no idea. If I had to go to anybody, it would be some of my teachers at Bolton School in the English department. A wonderful man called Charles Winder, who was the head of the English department. He knew that I think that I had a love of literature. I've been an obligate reader since a very, very young age. Yeah. I could read before I went to primary school, which was tricky because you're in the lessons and I was reading sort of children's treasury versions of Coral Island, that kind of thing. Yeah. And it's back to Nippy's our dog, Fluffy's our cat. You know, child me was probably a little bit turned off by that to some extent. But Charles Winder spotted, I think, that I had that love of literature and of words and started putting books towards me. When I was at school, you might want to read this, Richard. You might enjoy this, Richard. Yeah. And I think then there were other teachers that on the English side that spotted that.
And isn't it so important, isn't it, with teachers? The teachers are so much more than just teachers, aren't they?
They were. And I think back to some of the teachers I had. I had some, again, through secondary school, I was at Bolton School and then at Keswick School for my A-levels. Just great teachers.
All right, well, let's go back to your policing career. So you joined the police. Just which force did you join?
Well, I joined Lancashire. That was the force I wanted to join. I was born and brought up in Lancashire. So that had an affinity to Lancashire. I remember the process. I was there with, I think, a dep and a couple of supers being interviewed. And there was three of us there, ended up being on my intake. So they did the usual questions and stuff. And I think I was asked about women in policing, arming the police, you know, just a few bits and pieces, time when you've been physically brave or stood up for yourself. Any questions, Mr. Horton? Well, yeah, this process has taken about 6 months. How long will it make for you to make a decision? Oh, about 10 minutes, just wait outside. That was a proper heart in the mouth moment. Yeah, so I'm out there. They came out after about 10 minutes. We're having you all. If you follow this officer to clothing stores, we'll get you measured up for your uniform.
Wow.
And I had no idea. So I went in thinking I was having an interview and I'd find out. And I walked out being measured up for uniform and ready for my first start date in the June of that year. So I joined, went through training school, went through DT, the Divisional Training Centre, Bruges.
Yes, lovely Bruges.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed myself, to be fair. And it was a good experience. Then was onto the training scale at Blackburn, which was based in a couple of porter cabins at the bottom of the old yard at Northgate. You know, I think about, again, quality tutor constables back then.
Yeah.
You know, had some really quality people in there.
Yeah, they were mentors, weren't they?
They were. And then I was posted to Darwin, and Darwin Town Centre Foot. That was my first posting. I got kind of lucky during that time. I locked up a lot of people, to be fair. I locked up a lot of people for burglary, car crime. Decent amount of process going in, usually dangerous parts, that kind of thing. That was my bread and butter. But it sort of drew attention from headquarters, so I got co-opted onto a divisional proactive team targeting burglaries and the like. And then I spent a little bit of time as a neighbourhood officer for Harcroft and Infirmary in Blackburn. But that was back in the days when a chief inspector would say, give me 18 months, 2 years on this and I'll put you on CID. Because I set out my stall early. I wanted to go on CID. That was my thing. So then on to CID. I never really went back after that for about 20 years. And went through various departments. I was one of the first Home Office-funded hate crime specialist detectives working out of Blackburn. Worked on the high-tech crime unit for quite a while. Was sent away to Royal Military College of Science at Shrivenham to do a computer forensics course there and various other courses. And then went on to FMIT, the Major Investigation Team, or the sort of murder squad in old money, if you will, murders and stranger rapes, and had a thoroughly good time on there as well. Then from there, moved on to CID at Leyland, had a spell as Acting Detective Sergeant for 6 months there, then did a spell as an Acting Sergeant on Response at Preston. And when I was substantively promoted, I was promoted onto Response Team 2 at Preston. Again, I enjoyed that so much that I never wanted to go back to CID again. You're at the bottom of another steep learning curve. After 20 years in CID of one sort or another, you're a uniform sergeant. And I really relished that, really enjoyed getting better at that craft of being a uniform supervisor. I've been doing that for 3.5, 4 years, and in fairly sad circumstances, one of the sergeants in the licensing department took ill. He never returned to work, unfortunately, but I was asked if I could fill in for him. It then became a full-time post for me. And it's very, very different work in licensing. You're dealing with, in my case, 4 local authorities, Lancashire County Council, Trading Standards, Customs and Excise. Well, it's a lot of partnership type working, a lot of enforcement working.
A lot of
working.
Politics as well, I suspect.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, a lot of politics. And some local authorities more than others. If I'm honest, it's one of those lucky glide path to retirement jobs for a sergeant. It's responsible. You have staff, you have some big decisions to make. Pretty much left alone to get on with it, which again is good. I closed quite a few pubs. I think my parting gift, together with Chorley Borough Council to Lancashire Policing, was Applejack's nightclub in Chorley, which we had the licence removed from. So that just became just a building. And it had been historically a place where...
I've got to say, you weren't just closing pubs because for the sake of it.
Oh,
there was
no.
There, wasn't there?
There was huge problems there and had been for years. And it got to the point where 16-year-olds were being pulled out of there by the parents. It was just noise, violence. Every aspect of the licensing act that you could breach, they were breaching. It got to the point where we had to go to the council to a review. But that was as a parting gift. No more will Chorley Bobbies have to turn up at 5 a.m. to a fight outside Applejack's, because that's gone. So yeah, that was my career. And then since then, I've not been back. Haven't really thought about it that much, which...
Good.
Yeah, it leads me to think...
Good.
...that although I found policing fascinating, interesting, rewarding, it possibly never got into my soul, because I haven't missed it. I haven't had that yearning to go back to it. And I do wonder if that's been the case with me.
Well, I think a lot of that is, A, you have other interests and you have other passions, and writing is one of them. And it's also a fact that, you know, you do give a lot of yourself, don't you? And for, certainly for me, it's like, well, I've done my service now. This is my gift to society, a bit of me time now.
That's a very good way of putting it, Dave.
And somebody said something very interesting to me about well-being in the police was that, you know, people say, I'm a police officer. No, you're not. You're Richard or you're Dave who does the job of a police officer. And there's a subtle difference there.
It's absolutely right.
Well, All right, well, you know, we talked about your writing or your love of writing a little bit earlier. So, and you also mentioned the Night Chat blog. So what kind of prompted you to start a blog?
I have my own Wikipedia page because of that blog. And the reason that I started was back around 2008, 2009, they used to talk about the blogosphere, and there's not so much of it now, but there used to be a lot of people had blogs where you'd write a piece about something that interested you. And I started reading two in particular, the Inspector Gadget blog.
Good one.
It's a superb blog. And there was a blog called The Law West of Ealing Broadway, which is the magistrate's blog, an anonymous magistrate's blog. After about a month of writing responses to some of their blog posts, I realised that my responses weren't as long and as involved as the original blog posts. I got to thinking that it would be interesting to write a blog because I perhaps had some things to say about policing and about the politics around policing, but I'd probably better do it anonymously. So I put the name Nightjack. Nightjack is a police slang term. On any given night shift, there is usually one detective in the division somewhere who's left to cover any bad jobs that require CID that come in overnight, and they're called the Nightjack. Jack being slang term for detective, so it's the night detective. So I thought Nightjack would be a good name for the blog. Police would know what it meant from inside the job, and it had that sort of slightly dark feeling about it. Mm. So I went with that.
It was seedy, isn't it?
Well, it is a little bit, yeah. I started writing. The first thing I wrote was a thing called What is a Prison For? And that was from a reply to a blog post on the Law West of Ealing Broadway. Why do we have prisons? It starts off with putting forward the idea, well, they're not particularly for punishment and they're not particularly for rehabilitation. So perhaps they're just there to give the rest of us a break from some people in society for a lot of cases. Because if you wanted it to be punishment, they'd be harder than they were. If you wanted it to be rehabilitation, you'd put more work into the rehabilitation and more money into the rehabilitation side of it. So it's warehousing. That was my point. I carried on writing. I had a series called Only 24 Hours to Crack the Case, which was some fairly heavily disguised accounts of cases that I'd worked on, which seemed to go down fairly well. And then the Orwell Awards came about, and the Orwell Awards are a pretty big journalistic and writing prize, one of the big ones on the journalism side of writing. And I made the long list for the Orwell Prize, and I was quite surprised by that, but gratified, and I thought that would be the end of it.
Yes.
And around about that time, I'd kind of finished writing what I wanted to write on the blog. There's a thing, The Curse of the Green Biro, and it's when you get these letters that come in to police stations written on Izal toilet paper in green biro, complaining about something, you know, the smell from some drains or something.
I think I've seen some of these letters.
Well, we've all, I think, seen some of these letters that come in. And I felt I was getting a little bit green biro. I said what I wanted to say, and then there gets a point when you just become perhaps a sort of a mocking tone, a sarcastic tone. You can police your own tone with these things. I realised that perhaps the curse of the green biro had struck with me a little bit. Yeah. Also, I was studying for my sergeant's exams, so I didn't have the same time in the evenings for blogging. So I put the blog on box. Anyway, it then made the shortlist for the Orwell Prize, which meant that there was an invite to come down for a big awards dinner in London. Well, I couldn't go, obviously, I was an anonymous blogger.
Yes.
I did get a phone call from the chair of the committee, just checking out my bona fides. What I'd always said in the blog was I was a middle-aged bloke in a northern constabulary working as a detective. And I was able to satisfy them that I was, in fact, a middle-aged bloke in a northern constabulary working as a detective. So they were happy on that basis to go ahead. And I sent down a colleague who'd come to work with me on a particularly long and involved job, which took us out to Portugal. But he was a civilian employee, an ex-inspector from West Yorkshire called Robert Bolt. So I sent Rob down with a little speech in his pocket in case I won it. We won it. And I got a phone call from Rob from, you won it. And I was eating sausage and chips at the time. So I cracked open a bottle of champagne I had in the fridge as well.
Yeah.
Was really happy. There was, I think, a £3,000 prize, which went to the Police Dependence Trust.
Oh, good for you.
Afterwards, there was a number of newspapers wanted to quote chunks of the blog. So I charged them journalistic rates per word to be paid to the Police Dependence Trust as well. So that all went fine. And I thought, you know, I've kind of managed to write the blog. I've got a really good prize out of it. I've got the satisfaction of knowing that people think my writing is good and have enjoyed it. And I've managed to keep my anonymity. Yeah. Little did I know.
But then it started to go wrong.
Yes. There was a call into the constabulary asking for if he had any library pictures of me from the Times newspaper. And my DA at the time had a word with me. Do you know why this might be, Richard? Why the times might be? What's in your photograph? And then I got a phone call from a journalist at the time saying he'd identified me.
Did the organisation know at that point that you'd been doing a plug?
No, they had no idea. There was nobody at all in the organisation that had been writing Blog Nightjack. Although, strangely, a number of people had come to me and went and said, you know, like, this is Blog Nightjack, Richard. You should read it. I think you'd really enjoy it. And you bite your tongue. And you do what you can with that. Anyway, I got a phone call from this journalist at the Times, and he's saying, we've identified you as the author of the Nightjack blog, and we're going to publish. They'd also made a telephone call to the Professional Standards Department saying, we have information, Richard Horton's the author of the Nightjack blog, I'm going to publish it. So it was an interesting day, to say the least. I had a meeting with the PSD and my DI at my home. Yes, I'm the author of the blog, I wrote it, it's all me.
Yeah.
Nobody else involved, me. And they were really clear about it. If it's racist, sexist or homophobic, you're down the road. Yeah. If it's not, well, we'll see what the rest of it is. And I was pretty happy with that, because the racism, sexism, homophobia thing, that's not in my writing because it's not in me. No. So it's good. Then I rang the Orwell Prize, the chair of the Orwell Prize, and said, I may have a problem. I think the Times have identified me. And within an hour, I had operating for me a very eminent privacy law solicitor called Daniel Tench from Allswangs. And Hugh Tomlinson QC is one of the top privacy law QCs in the country. And they were acting pro bono because they couldn't see a public interest in identifying me. And we went to the High Court and I obtained a temporary injunction from them on the basis that I believed that they'd obtained the information unlawfully by hacking an email account of mine. They denied it and they put a statement in. But it took them about a month to overturn the injunction. And they put a statement in saying, we didn't do it by hacking his email account. We did it by proper journalistic means, following a little breadcrumbs through his writing, and that's how we did it. And we weren't able to get past that denial, so the Times published a month after they'd made that phone call. In the meantime, Professional Standards had split the blog up into two-month sections and given one to every investigator to read through.
Who probably found it thoroughly enjoying, I suspect.
Strangely enough, I know that to be for a fact to be true. At the end, I was offered a misconduct meeting. That was good because in the police discipline system, for a misconduct hearing, you can lose your job. Yes. At a misconduct meeting, you can't. So at that point, I knew whatever else happened, I was still going to be in the police and I still had my job. And I'm really, really happy about that. Took a lot of pressure off. I got a 12-month written warning on the basis, I think, somewhat of Nightjack's third law, which was, I'd put various laws of policing through the blog, and one of them, Nightjack's third law, was there's no situation so bad, so awful, so messed up beyond recall that you can't make it worse by adding a social worker. And
oh, dear.
I know. That was probably during my green biro phase, as they say. So I accepted my 12-month written warning and got on with the job. I had to write a piece for the Times. They waived their legal fees, which would have been moderately ruinous if I failed. I now know they probably waived the legal fees because they knew they had actually obtained my details by hacking an email account.
Yes.
That's by the by. I wrote a piece for them, which I think of as my Tornado Down piece. And then I thought little more about it, except that the taste for writing had kind of gone out of me for a while.
Yeah.
It's difficult. I had a photojournalist come to the front door at my home address. My wife and my son had to leave and go overnight to mum and dad's for a couple of days to sort of keep their heads low while it broke. It had some effect there, and I suppose it had some effect at work at a commendation ceremony about 2 months after the whole Nightjack thing had happened. And the chief at that time and the dep both sort of buttonholed me, and you're not still writing, are you, Richard? I still have my Twitter account, I have IV, but even there you're kind of aware people know who you are. I never tweeted anonymously, I was always Richard Horton. At IOVIV, and people knew who I was and what I was, and that I'd be the author of Nightjack. So, people are always watching that, and it puts a bit of a constraint on you. Maybe it's a good thing to some extent, because if you're tweeting publicly as a police officer, there's actually a constraint on you there.
Yeah. Well, I always laugh when I see tweet accounts from police officers, and they say, these are my views, not of the organisation. It's like, that is just a ridiculous caveat, because it doesn't exist.
Absolutely. If people know that you're a police officer and you're commenting on matters of policing and criminal law and policy, you're commenting as a police officer.
Yes.
There's no way around that. I kind of put that all to bed. I got a little bit interested in music. I like recording bits of music. Mm. Although, given the state of my voice, I've gone more to instrumentals over the years. Still looking for a singer, but I'll see how that goes. And thought really nothing more about it for possibly a decade. Night Jack sort of disappeared into the past, and there's a few copies left. I think there's a copy in the British Library Archive. There's a Wayback Machine copy, but there isn't any live copies of Night Jack. There's a book, an American guy who was a professional typesetter.
Yes.
Typeset the whole blog and put a cover on it.
Yes.
It's a great cover, and it's available through Lulu, I think. Yes. I don't make anything off of that, neither does he.
Yes.
When I found out he'd done it, I just sent him an email saying, thank you, the book looks wonderful.
Yeah.
Please don't try and make this commercial.
Yeah.
And he hasn't, to be fair. It just sits there. Then we came to the Leveson inquiry and the involvement of David Alan Green, who's a lawyer in London,
quite a renowned lawyer, in fact.
He is, and a very prominent Twitter commentator on Brexit, for example. He's had a lot to say about Brexit. He's had a lot to say about the COVID legislation. And he'd been, an admirer of the Night Jack blog in the past and enjoyed reading it. So Leveson comes along, and it's the inquiry into phone hacking initially. And there's some disclosure made by the Times newspaper that around the time that the Night Jack thing was being done by the Times, a journalist had been sacked. And shortly afterwards, the head of legal at Times, his services had been dispensed with. And this perked David Alan Green's interest. And he did a bit of further digging and I think made a representation to Leveson that there was something around the Night Jack hacking possibly in the Times. And so the Times coughed up a whole load of emails, which made it abundantly clear that they'd first identified me by hacking an email account belonging to me. Now, in that email account, I had an offer from a literary agency. They wanted to know where to send the papers if I was going to sign up a contract with them. So I sent them back an email with my home address on it and my actual name and details. Mm-hmm. They'd hacked my email account, a journalist called Patrick Foster, and found that email, which from there they knew who I was, where I lived. But for the course of the injunction, they kind of worked backwards from knowing who I was, knowing where I lived, and were able to just about breadcrumb backwards.
Yes.
But as Leveson was saying, once you've got all the edges on the jigsaw, which you had, the rest is you told the court that you hadn't hacked the email accounts.
Which is a really important point, isn't it?
It is. And that's what got me a decent settlement later down the line. So I remember the day that came by and I rang Daniel Tench, the solicitor that had acted for me, and he said, unfortunately, Richard, cannot act for you because my firm's now retained by News International. Then I ended up going to the solicitor who represented the Dowler family. You remember Millie Dowler?
Yes.
When her phone had been hacked and it had resulted in the family perhaps thinking she was still alive and using the phone when she wasn't. So I went to that solicitor. I picked up the phone. It was a little bit James Bond. It was, oh, Mr. Horton, I've been expecting your call. And then it was just, I'll advise you, I'll do this on a contingent fee basis. I think you have a very strong case, having seen the emails that have been backwards and forwards and disclosed at Leveson. So I then waited and there was various offers being made. And each time I was thinking, that's a lot of money.
Yes.
And each time he was saying, that's not enough money, Richard. We ended up settling for, I think, $42,500.
Wow.
And I got an apology on the front page above the fold on the Times, which I was very, very happy about. Back at Leveson, Michael Alistair Brett, who was the head of legal at the Times, was cross-examined by Brian Leveson QC. He's, I think, formerly a criminal barrister in Merseyside at the Liverpool Crown, mostly. And I had the pleasure of watching this man who had connived in a lie about me before the High Court, being carted round courtroom for 15 or 20 minutes by a QC who really knows his business. Mm. Really stuck the knife in him. And it was good to see. There's the old African phrase, if you wait by the river long enough, the body of every enemy will come floating past. Now, I waited the best part of a decade, but those bodies came floating past. Yes. I got a good settlement from the Times, which I was happy about. I felt a sense of justice. I didn't have all of that hanging over my head anymore. It was debt discharged kind of thing.
Yes.
And largely, I say that's down to David Alan Green, him picking up. Odd, they should have lost a journalist and the head of legal about the time of the Night Jack outing.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's connected in any way, and of course it was.
Yes.
Which was great.
And I suppose it's important to say as well, all this, that it's all a matter of public record.
It absolutely is, yes.
So there's nothing you're saying that isn't contentious or defamatory. It's there.
Exactly right. It's all that. If you want to see Alistair Brett being carted around the courtroom by Brian Leveson, it's still there as a video. If you want to see the Times emails that were there, I think the Jack of Kent blog, which is one of David Alan Green's blog, has a Night Jack page, the anatomy of us, something or other. But he just goes very forensically through all of the case material.
And we said, didn't we, the important point was it was evidence obtained by hacking.
Yes.
My understanding is that there's no public interest defence to that. It would be understandable if you were, but you don't seem particularly bitter.
I'm not. I've offered Patrick Foster, who hasn't taken me up, that next time, you know, if I'm in London ever, I wouldn't mind having a pint with him as a journalist who hacked my email and outed me. And he ended up being arrested. He ended up getting a criminal caution for what he did. And he lost his job. And his employer ended up paying me a fairly good chunk of money.
Yeah.
And there's no point feeling bitter about him. He obviously thought he had a great scoop on the day and he unmasked this anonymous prize-winning blog author. And it all kind of backfired on him in the end.
Yeah. How do you feel about the organisation?
I have to say, Lancashire Constabulary, I think, played a blinder. They looked after me. We've got a month. We'll get it sorted within a month. Then it's going to be a misconduct meeting after they'd read it. And I think that stance that if it's racist, sexist or homophobic, you're getting sacked. That's got to be right. And this is back in 2009.
Yeah, that's fair enough, isn't it?
It's absolutely fair enough. Those things are incompatible with being a police officer. I felt that the arm went round a little bit from the organisation. But it's a two-way street because I'm giving them a thing that they can solve and sort and have some comfort on. In the end, when the Times came to them saying, OK, we've overturned the injunction, we are going to publish, the Constabulary's statement was something along the lines of an officer from the Constabulary's admitted being the author of the Nightjack blog and has received an appropriate disciplinary sanction. Full stop, end of press statement.
Yeah.
And it's boxed off. Well, there's none of that. Well, what are you going to do with him? We have done. We've read it. It's not racist, sexist, homophobic.
Yeah.
He's got a 12-month written warning in respect of his writing. That's the end of it for us. Unless he reoffends within the 12 months kind of thing.
Yeah. As they say, the detective will rule off new page.
Well, indeed. Absolutely right, yeah. I felt the organisation dealt with it professionally, properly. The Federation were great. They perhaps didn't have an idea what was going on initially.
Yes.
But they were supportive. My line management, right up to chief superintendent, were supportive. So I think once they understood that it was basically police commentary and nothing that was way out in left field and wrong, I think somebody sort of took to the heart of what it was of being a detective.
Do you think if that blog had been written now, in 2022, that perhaps the same sanctions would have been given to you?
I think my job would have been more at risk if I was doing it now.
Really?
I do.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. The big thing, the thing that college police talk about all the time, the HMIC talk about all the time, the Police Foundation report talks about, and the most recent report on Stop Search, is confidence in policing. And if you do something that is seen now as diminishing or harming police confidence, so public confidence in policing, that's a really serious thing now.
And it's a very, very wide topic fall over, isn't it?
It's a much wider net, it's a much finer net, rather, than racist, sexist, homophobia.
Yeah.
So I think that they've looked at that, well, you've done harm to the confidence of the public in policing, goodbye. I think it's much more likely to happen. If somebody used to do my blog now,
Yes,
I think that would be much more likely to happen.
Yeah. I'm so glad that it's not destroyed your love of writing, and I know that you're collaborating with a friend, a police colleague, Steve Bradshaw, and myself on a new podcast called The Thin Blue Mind, which is, between us, we're looking at various policing issues. And I hope we've just done a pilot episode. I hope we don't come across as three grumpy, bitter old men, because certainly from my perspective, and I suspect yours as well, and Steve's, we're none of us are bitter about our service. We've only good things to say. Yes, there are moments in our careers which have been pretty dark, but overall it's something I've thoroughly enjoyed and probably would do again.
I would definitely do it again. I said at the start of the podcast that policing probably didn't get in my soul, but it doesn't mean I don't love it. And I've, as an occupation, I have loved doing it. I've loved being part of it. And I hate what I see as harm being done to it over the last decade of my service.
And there's certainly enough out there at the moment that people are trying to do exactly that, aren't they?
I think so. And if I have an opinion on it, and the Thin Blue Mind podcast lets me get some of that out in a reasoned way, without the green biro slipping onto the page, then that's a thing I'd be very interested in doing, I want to do. Because there is things to be said about policing, and there are things that it is easier or better to say when you're recently out from the job, as we call it. And it holds true for chief constables. The number of times you'll see a chief constable on the way out in the last week or weeks or months, going to the local press often and saying, this is why things have been so awful and these are the bad things that have happened to us, the bad things that are happening to us. Things that it's difficult for them to say whilst they're still in service, because a chief constable has such an amount of politics involved. But I feel the same thing, as I said to you, in 2 years, the job will have changed out of all recognition again.
Yeah, we'll be out of touch, won't we?
Yeah, and I don't want to be one of those voices in the wilderness, the sort of embittered ex-cop in media.
Yeah.
So I've set a shelf life on it.
Yeah.
And when I think, and I think it's going to be 2 years max, that I no longer have anything relevant to say about policing, that I'm too far gone from the game.
Yes.
It's time to stop. And I've got other things to do in life.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have my music, I have my little job at Sainsbury's, stacking the shelves and doing the bakery. I have my volunteer work at the library. I have a retirement to get on with, some more time under canvas, good holidays, you know, all that good retirement stuff. So I won't be short of things to do if I don't have a podcast anymore. But but I'm very keen to do it whilst I still can and while it's still relevant.
Yeah. Well, I suspect there's probably still a little bit of night chat left. Some unfinished business, and
you'd be right.
And that, and our new podcast will perhaps be a good medium for that, perhaps.
I think so.
Well, Richard Horne, it's been an absolute delight. Thank you.
And similar, Dave. That's similar.
Until we speak again on our other podcast. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.